Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Mesa City Council study session for Thursday, September 9th, 2010. Would like to excuse Councilmember Summers, who's out of town today. I think Councilmember Richardson just ran a bit late. I also like to apologize for my voice. It's a little croaky, croggy, froggy. The bad news is you'll have to hear it. The good news is I won't get to speak as much. That's really good news, huh, Councilmember Gillis? The bad news is I still will speak. First item on the agenda is to review the agenda for next Monday's City Council meeting. Page 2. Page 3. Page 4. Page 5. Councilmember Higgins.
Item 6A.
6A.
6A. It's just introduction?
Yes.
Right, but I still have some concerns with some of the things the applicant is requesting, basically side yard setbacks. And we talked about it last week in relation with the new zoning code update. And there's other items too, but so maybe we can get together and talk about some of these things.
Sure.
Awesome. Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
What is this? How do I say this? Do you have any idea? Are they looking at moving forward with the actual development of this, or is this just a zoning update, or is that just a really dumb question?
Mayor, they are moving forward with the actual development. Their approval plans are done. They're ready to move on the first phase.
Okay. Anything else on page 5? Page 6. Okay. We're gonna flip a couple of items on the agenda because we have visitors with us here today. We're going to go to item number 3, which is to hear a presentation discuss the retail analysis for the proposed spring training sites. So, Mr. Brady, if you'd introduce our guests.
Thank you, Mayor. Council recall, back in the 1st of July, the city sought to receive more information regarding the proposed the sites that are under consideration for the new spring training sites for the Cubs. And as such, we engaged some outside consultants to conduct a retail analysis for the city to help further kind of our understanding and information about the different sites and what they may be able to, the demand that they would be able to reflect for potential retail opportunities, especially as it relates to what the Cubs have been visiting about as far as the Wrigleyville concept. With that, I contacted Mr. Todd Kerr, who's here today, who's here locally, who lives in Mesa, works in Scottsdale, but has a lot of experience in conducting this type of analysis throughout the valley, and I'll let him explain that a little bit more. Todd, Mr. Kerr, also suggested that we acquire the advice and consulting services of Munson Research, and I'll let them introduce themselves. The purpose of this report is to at least give us a pretty detailed analysis of the retail demand for the different sites. As I've explained in the past, it really is not intended necessarily to come to a conclusion today about which would be the best site for spring training, but to really kind of begin laying the groundwork for the types of retail that would best be situated for each one and identify their strengths and weaknesses. So there's a lot of detail here that's been provided. So with that, I'll ask Todd if he'll maybe introduce himself again and then introduce Munson Research and then go through the PowerPoint that they have for the council today.
Great. Thank you very much. It's nice to be with all of you today. My name is Todd Kerr. I'm with the Brown Group, and we are headquartered here in Scottsdale, at least north of you here in Scottsdale. We are primarily shopping center developers. We've been doing this for close to about 18 years. We've been working in the states of Arizona, California, Utah, Nevada, New Mexico, and Missouri. We are active today, even though the economy is not great, as you all know, for development. We are still active, even though the volume of business is not what it once was. We have developed over 6 million feet of shopping center ground floor area, and we will continue to do so in the future. Let me just say at the outset that as I was asked to undertake this assignment from Mr. Brady, that I was asked to meet with a representative of the Chicago Cubs, and I did so. I met with Mr. David Scholl, who is Vantage Partners, also in Scottsdale, and Mr. Scholl had been hired by the Cubs to perform his own analysis and review the subject sites. In this meeting, I was able to hear of their vision for what they wanted to do once the site was selected. Without getting into too much detail, it was clear that the Cubs envision a new stadium and the opportunity to develop a retail center at some point in time, maybe not concurrently with the initial development of the stadium, but at some point when it's justified. They see this as being maybe a, not necessarily a replica, but it would have something of the spirit of Wrigleyville back in Chicago. I've never personally been there. I've done some reading on it. I understand it's a very unique area. It's all centered around the Chicago Cubs and Wrigley Field. And it's primarily an area of some specialty retail, restaurants, clubs. There's some museums and art galleries and other types of specialty retail. Based upon this and his explanation that they envision this center being a not only having a retail component, but that it would also have a component of some offices with a rehabilitation center and a nutrition center for their players. They would conduct the annual draft at this location. And then they also envisioned some other businesses being brought in that would be special and unique to the area that would really play off the Cubs brand. That is what they saw as happening here. As we looked at this, it was not obvious that the what the necessary pull would be from something like this. When you do a retail development, you have to have what we call an anchor. You need something that will justify continual traffic in and out of that center. Here we were not completely sure of the degree of the pull on a 365-day basis. And so we had to take more of a traditional analysis of each of these three sites, basically utilizing standard and accepted criteria in the evaluation of retail sites. That is what we've done. Now, you have a center or a study here that's somewhat voluminous, and we've attempted today in this presentation, we're going to attempt to simplify this for you. And so we'll go ahead and get started. With that, I'd now like to introduce you to John Tippetts with Munson Research.
I am Vice President of Operations and Information Systems for Munson Research. Our company's been in existence since 2004, although most of the partners have been in this business for well over 10 years, as I have myself. We provide developers and retailers and government agencies the information they need to make the best decision they can for retail establishments. We use scientific approach to identifying and qualifying potential retail developments, and our expertise is in computer gravity modeling, and we use GIS information systems, spatial relationship analysis, psychographics, etc. With that, I'd like to turn to the PowerPoint presentation. How do I get that on the screen? There we go. The project scope includes, we were commissioned to analyze the strengths and weaknesses of these three potential sites for the Cubs complex with a retail ancillary component. The ancillary component, the retail component, was to include a specialty group of stores or lifestyle type retail. So we were commissioned to analyze the southwest corner of East University Drive and North Mesa Drive. We call that downtown site throughout the report. The northwest corner of North Dobson Road and West 8th Street, we call that the Riverview site. And the southwest corner of East Thomas Road and North Wrecker Road, we call that the Wrecker site throughout the report. Keep in mind, we were not commissioned or asked to give any recommendations, only analyze the strengths and weaknesses of each of these sites. We will provide individual site characteristics and give you site trade area demographics. The individual site characteristics include access, which is, these are all important components for retail developments. Retail synergy, traffic counts, visibility, retail competition, vacancy. And the demographic characteristics include population, population growth, ethnicity, establishments, employees, the shoppers between the ages of 18 to 15, median age, median income, and average income. Also those with what level of college degree. Besides the primary trade area, and let me define the primary trade area real quick. The primary trade area is basically where 70 to 80% of the consumers would shop in each of these particular three sites. It extends farther. There'll be people who will drive farther, but most of the people who will shop day to day will live within this primary trade area. But we also give you information based on a 1, 3, and 5 mile ring, as well as a 20-minute drive time, and you'll see that throughout the report. The deliverables include a site assessment, a projected trade area, which includes the primary trade area, the 1, 3, 5 mile. The 20-minute drive time. We provide demographic profiles of each of those three components as well. We compare the demographics for each of the three sites, and then the strengths and weaknesses, which I'm assuming will be the most important to you. So with that, let's start with the downtown site, the one at University of Mesa. This site, as you can see from the map and in your report, the primary trade area is somewhat smaller due to drive times and access to the site. All of the roads that serve this site are surface streets rather than freeway or limited access highways. With most of these components, we evaluated whether it was a weakness or a strength. So the access for this particular site is a weakness because there are no freeway or major highways within a 3 mile radius. There is potential for traffic congestion during peak traffic hours. You'll see later that the traffic count's quite high due to signalized intersections and surface street conditions. Limited speed can contribute to congestion. The light rail is, just want to mention, the light rail is to be completed in 2016, will likely improve access to this site, but those impacts have not been studied in this report, just for your information.
Let me ask you something, though, about
sure.
that, because I'm curious. You know, one of the things that light rail, it's like a freeway, but it's a different kind of freeway in that, basically, once you get off, if you're on a freeway, you take an exit ramp and you still are in a car and you can drive.
Correct.
Even with that, we know that access off a freeway, if you're more than you know, like one, if you have to cross like one major arterial, then the effect of the impact of the freeway is diminished. On light rail, you get off, you step off a train, and you're on your
feet.
If we look at this site, one thing that's always that I've always questioned is whether people would walk a half a mile for retail. Now, I know you didn't study this in this, but in your experience, and maybe I'm asking you something, just maybe this is a common sense type of thing. The question is if this were right on Main Street, I mean literally bordering Main Street, where someone got off and walked from this to the station versus Site 17's, like you said, nearly half a mile away, it would seem common sense that would be a very different scenario, that something that's that far removed would not benefit as greatly from light rail as, let's say, if it were right on Main Street. I mean, is that just a...
Well, I think you'd see the stadium component, you'd get a lot of traffic.
We've seen that people will walk for a special event, right, or for something like that.
But the retail component would not likely...
Day in and day out, in your experience, you would question whether that would have an impact, whether they would actually walk that.
We did not do any research of light rail as part of this study.
I understand that.
In my experience, I did live in Portland and used light rail, and that is a valid observation. People don't walk more than... I mean, if it's past a mile, you're not going to get pedestrian traffic. Half a mile is stretching it, probably. So I think that's a valid observation that you've...
Okay, well, I get it that wasn't included in your study. But you can't ignore the fact that, you know, light rail in downtown with this, you know, you just can't ignore that exists. And there's going to be the question asked. And I get it that there wasn't any formal part of your study that had that. But just wanted to get your observation on that. Councilmember Kavanaugh?
Just a question on the, you're on the downtown area right now, and you mentioned a moment ago that your traditional analysis, you look at the 1, 3, and 5 mile rings, and you're the primary trade area. In the text of your report, you actually have a map of the 1, 3, and 5 mile rings for the Riverview and the Wrecker site, but there's no on pages 59 and 79. But I don't see a similar map for downtown. Is that just an omission from the report? You discuss it, but I don't remember seeing...
That's an inadvertent omission.
Yeah, thank you. Didn't we tell... Wasn't there one shown on the... Maybe
no,
I was
not
looking
the
on...
Not the
okay,
ring.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, I mean, it was studied.
Right. That would be... Right. I think that would be helpful for us if you do an omission or do an addition.
Yeah, maybe if you could just add that to the...
The ring analysis is different from the PTA.
It is.
The primary trade area analysis. And that's because those areas clearly are identified in the report for the three sites. But
all the information is there. The map was inadvertently omitted.
Great.
You'd have to extrapolate it out of the narrative versus being able to visually look at the things.
We can provide that.
Thank you.
Mayor, if we can just go back to the earlier question that you raised. One thing that I think we need to make a distinction on as it relates to light rail is that traffic as it relates to a sporting event, people have shown time and time again that they're willing to walk.
Yeah.
The distinction is, are they there for the sporting event or are they there to do some shopping? If they're there for shopping and they have large transactions or they're buying lots of things, they don't... Customers, from my experience in retail, have shown they don't like to walk a long way when they have a lot of things that they're carrying. So that would be the issue that would have to be looked at. And so,
well, the other thing is too is if they have options. I mean, especially in Arizona, in the middle of July or August, the question is that, you know, what they may be going to may be really special, but is it special enough to overcome a half mile walk in 110 degree heat when they can either drive there, and then you get into what you're talking about as far as the limited accessibility. And with the ease of accessibility, not the limited, but the ease of accessibility. And, you know, what other options? At that point in time, I mean, you know, I'm going someplace I can park and make the trip as on foot as short as possible.
And this is a community that is really married to its cars. I mean,
There's no doubt that light rail changes things, but it's changed, the area of change is very... And it is very well defined by experience. Like you said, we can look at other cities and see how that works, and also by the type of activity. Going to downtown Phoenix, you go to a Diamondbacks or Suns game, and I've taken light rail in there, and you will walk a couple, three blocks, no problem at all. I'm not sure I would get on light rail and go into downtown Phoenix to a restaurant three blocks away, unless I had to, in the middle of summer. Right. But I'll go to a ball game because it's a different experience. That's the only place I can go to the ball game.
Yep.
I got no choice. But I can go to many different restaurants or other things, no matter how special they are. And not that I won't go to them, but I'll just choose a different time to go to them. Okay. Councilman Fenter.
Just a brief point. It's mentioned here 2016 for the light rail. And it kind of leaves the impression for some folks that that's a long time down the road. But I know there's still a lot of discussions on everything that we're looking at in different formats. But it'll be interesting to see how that timeline would figure up with the timeline of doing Wrigley West someday.
Well, that's a great point, Councilman. I can tell you that right now, when you talk to any retailer, they are currently working on a 3 to 4 year timeline. Just to give you an idea, their growth plans, if they are some of the few that are growing right now, they're pretty much wrapping up 2012, and they're now working under 2013 plans. So 2016 for a retailer isn't out that far.
Okay.
Continue. Any other questions so far? The retail synergy, which is basically when you get a group of retailers together, and I think you've all observed this, tends to pull people from farther distance. If they have a place where they can do a one-stop shopping, they'll drive farther. So the synergy of downtown is also a weakness for this site, as there really isn't a whole lot of name brand national chains in the area. There are fewer retailers, and few of those are major retail national chains. Traffic counts are a strength in that there are a lot of people driving past this site. 59,300 average daily count in the major streets surrounding this site. It has the highest traffic count of the three sites. The streets are wide with protected turn lanes, but as we spoke before, they have limited speed limits, and intersection after intersection is signalized. Visibility is a weakness. It's flat. There is no major highway or road that is above grade that people, as they drive along, could see the site. The stadium would be visible, but the stadium could overshadow the retail component, somewhat hiding it if it's not planned correctly. The retail competition. This is somewhat opposite to the synergy. What competition surrounds this site? Well, this site has very little competition and therefore opens up many opportunities for major retailers. The vacancy surrounding the area is considered a weakness because that is competition for retail space. There's plenty of vacancy around this area. Any questions on the downtown? That was a real quick synopsis of downtown.
Councilmember Higgins?
I have a couple questions. One is, you talk in the report on page 29 about synergy of surrounding things like the Arts Mesa Arts Center, the Convention Center, and the Marriott Hotel. I just wonder why you left out the synergy that is created by the LDS Temple that has 3,000 to 5,000 people a day coming down. And I don't know if that wasn't, you didn't look across the street. I'm not sure what. I mean, it's within a half mile or a mile of that intersection. So to me, that's another huge piece of synergy for that area.
That's probably a valid point. I would tell you that a lot of those people that go to the temple are typically not always dressed, or they don't feel maybe, how do I put it? I don't know how much cross-shopping there would be with some of this. A lot of those folks are going there, and then they're going home right afterwards. So to be honest, we did not study that. We didn't look at that. And you may have a good point there. But we when we look at synergy, we look at other retail businesses in the area or other business-type activities that you will have there at the hotel, which is a great benefit. The convention hall is a great benefit. The things that became obvious that you could actually see people before or after the event, then going over into this area that's convenient, we could see some very convenient cross traffic there. So, you know, temple attendance, I'm not sure how that works, to be honest with you. It's a good question.
It's a great
very
question.
Good question.
Well, another question. Did you have some? I'm sorry.
I just wanted to add to that. When we did this report, we focused primarily on retail, other retail centers. There are a lot of private and maybe civic buildings and organizations that we didn't focus on or include in the, like the temple, that we didn't include in the report.
You know, I think anytime you have thousands of people within a proximity of something, it's something that should be looked at. But
you know what? I think we can say this. Anything that brings people into the area is a benefit. And I think from that standpoint, you've raised a very good point. And perhaps we probably should have caught that, but that's a good catch, I think, on your part.
All right, question I have, another, it's just a statement on page 31, which to me didn't make a lot of sense. I'm going to read it to you, if you don't mind. You just said, while these properties, and you're talking about all the vacant space around the downtown mm-hmm. site, the Target at Southern and Gilbert, and you right. have a list. Mm-hmm. He said, while these may be competitive with the downtown site, these will also be expensive to develop and will require a more complicated entitlement process.
Correct.
Well, they're already shopping centers, so I don't understand what entitlement process goes into something that's already a commercial shopping
center. Here's the point, and we maybe could have made this clearer, but the point is a lot of these centers have large boxes. What we are finding in the industry is a lot of these boxes can't be used again, and so they become teardowns, and then you're starting over. And then it becomes a matter of, can they afford to do that, and are there financial incentives that they need to look to the city to try to find a way to make these affordable? And so in the near term, there is an issue here, not only from financing, but also from just a utility basis. I don't remember the statistic, but there was a report recently that I want to say 20-30% of the big boxes will never be used again. And so there's some question in this area, and we raise it as an issue. It's not definitive, but it is something that has to be looked at.
So maybe the word isn't right, the entitlement process, because...
No, I think, that would then come down to how much the city would like to work with these people when they come in and look for help. So that's...
Well, the idea being, like what we've seen, is if big box retail worked there, it wouldn't be empty. And so you're going to have to look for a different use than big box.
And that is a great point.
For example, what we're looking at along Southern Avenue is to take that string of retail, which may never be retail, probably will never, it's probably included in that 30%. My guess is that 100% of that is included in that, which potentially may not be used again. So the question is, what do you go for? We're looking at hopefully some mixed use. Well, mixed use is a whole different, requires significant entitlements. Now, we'll make it as easy as possible, but you still got to go through that process.
That was where we were going with this. Yeah. We're seeing some of these properties nationally, they're being downzoned, and that's where it becomes a little bit dicey from a city standpoint, and just the overall change in zoning that does occur on occasion.
Councilman Finter?
As I'm looking at your matrix on page 10, and since we're just on downtown, I didn't want to get away from that. The way I've heard Wrigley West described in the past and in some of the meetings that we've had is a unique, high-quality regional draw. So the filter I'm putting on right now as we get this information is I'm trying to see, you know, when we're looking at sites, if that truly is what we're, and maybe that's the criteria you used. We don't know what that is yet. I think that's going to develop in the future. So access, I look at some of the weaknesses you mentioned, access, retail, synergy, all those. So if we have a unique, high-quality, regional draw type of center, which will be Wrigley West, doesn't that, the filter, I'm going to ask this question in my mind as we go through Riverview and different sites, using that criteria, what will overcome some of those weaknesses or what has helped? So if you know, as you go through this, using that, I guess it's just a statement, and I see where you've said, hey, here's the weaknesses, but if it's a unique, high-quality regional draw, doesn't that overcome some of those weaknesses? Is that the filter, or is that the way you looked at it as a possibility? Or I'm sorry, that's a little vague, but I'm trying to get through that in my own head.
Corollary to that, which I think you hit it on the head, is does it overcome that, and then also is it magnified? You know, for example, if it's a regional draw, does the lack of access in downtown, how would that work against that versus if we were looking at this as purely a neighbor, not only a neighbor, but a sub-regional type of a thing? I know you didn't make that leap.
We didn't make that leap, but there's a few things to consider.
Because we're going to have to make that leap to some degree or another.
And I'm glad it's you and not us. There's two issues. First is, what is the draw? What creates the draw? You know, it's easy to say it's a major retail center, but why? What is it within that center that creates that entire year draw? See, one of the challenges as we analyze this is when we looked at the spring training schedule, it's only 17 games.
Yeah.
What do we do for the rest of the year? I went out and I reviewed the Gateway Project out in Glendale. And the time I went, it was pretty sleepy. And they've got not only an arena, but a stadium there. The problem is, when it's not game day, there's not much going on. So the challenge will be, for anyone who undertakes this, what do we do here to create a continual draw of traffic? And we can't do that in this report. We don't know what that is.
That may not even be retail.
And it may not be. It may be.
And that's one of the challenges, like you said, because the Cubs aren't yet there. Hopefully they'll get there, like, real soon. But we don't know. I mean, we're using retail as the base because it's what we know, is what I'm gathering from this. It's the thing that we have the data on, and we can use that. And in this, you include retail, including the entertainment portion, such as restaurants and things like that. But we just don't know what that might be. But we can apply basic knowledge.
And that is what this report does. Yeah, we your point is right on, and it is the point. The unfortunate part is until we know what that is, we can't assess that. And so what we've had to do is apply very traditional retail criteria. So we have to make certain assumptions to say, well, given certain circumstances, this could be successful, and what would be those factors that would contribute to that success, and that is what we've done here.
I guess take that one step further. If the weaknesses are so great that traditional retail would not work, then I guess you could jump to a conclusion that it would have to be something extremely unique to overcome some of those weaknesses.
That was the second point.
And if the strengths are so dominant, then perhaps even something that isn't off the charts spectacular would still have a better chance of succeeding there. I mean, is that too far of a leap?
No, I think that's a good assumption. I mean, that's basically what they did at Riverview. I mean, although I don't want to get into Riverview's pros
Thank
or cons
you.
Right now. What I want to say is, though, if you took something like a Bass Pro and you put it over in any of these sites, and whatever weaknesses they may have could be overcome by that. It just depends on the caliber of draw that you create, and we don't know what that is. Okay.
Gotcha.
We did have to make an assumption, I mean, basically that these were a Wrigley-type, this would be a Wrigley-type retail center with specialty and lifestyle stores. That's a very broad paintbrush, but that's all we could use at this level of the, at this stage of the analysis. Any further questions on the downtown site before we move on to Riverview? Okay, the Riverview site at the northwest corner of Dobson Road and 8th Street. I'm sure everyone here is very familiar with the existing retail that is there. This has a little bit larger primary trade area because of the access, close to 202, which enables it to pull farther distance. As you look at the 20-minute drive time, it is the largest, or close to the largest. This one in Wrecker have the two largest 20-minute drive time areas. The access is a strength, has excellent freeway and major road access. The on-off ramp is right there, close. And it's the closest of the three sites to Sky Harbor International Airport. Retail synergy is a strength. A lot of major retailers there, as Todd already mentioned. You've got some strong retail components that pull people from quite a ways away. They'll drive a long ways to get to this particular development. There's a lot of national name brands that already exist there. Traffic counts are a strength. There's 38,000 combined average daily traffic counts in the surrounding roads.
Now, that doesn't include the freeway, right?
That's no, just it does not include the freeway. That's just surface streets.
Surface streets.
Mm-hmm. Visibility is a strength because you can see this development from 202. And with proper signage, could be seen from surface streets as well. It currently does have limited sight or visibility from the surface streets, which is the same as downtown. Retail competition is a weakness because there's a limited number of retailers that you could target additionally to what's already there. There's already major retailers.
So in other words, the synergy that creates a strength also creates sort of a weakness?
Can be a weakness as well. Mm-hmm.
Councilmember Cavanaugh.
And I'm actually following up on the mayor's comment. In the body of the report, when you're talking about the retail competition, you note that you were advised that Tempe Marketplace plans a fairly major 20-acre expansion to the east for additional retail. If that planned expansion occurs, is that going to be a strength or a weakness in terms of your analysis?
Do you want me to address that?
Go ahead.
Okay. It can be both. the most obvious answer here is that it will create more competition for retail placement to this site. Tempe Marketplace is fairly successful. It's done a great job of attracting some major retailers. If they expand, then those who want to be there, who are more focused on serving the kind of the North Tempe Marketplace and South Scottsdale, will be inclined to go there. So it creates a competitive situation from a tenant placement standpoint. So that's the most obvious answer, and we saw that as being material. The more competition you have to allow tenants to select, the more difficult it is to attract them to your center. You have competition. You have competition on rent rates, and they will also evaluate the tenant offering that exists there. So it's an obvious competition there.
Now, just probably information you didn't have. I have seen a plan for phase two, and it is not retail centered, which surprised me. It's a more mixed use type of a.
I don't doubt that, Mayor.
I know you mentioned, for example, Sam's Club. My understanding is that Walmart that option has actually lapsed, and that Walmart is indicated now. I can't speak for them, but I was told. So this is third person.
And I can't vouch for whose information is better. This was information we got about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
And the understanding was that it at least has been put on hold, long term hold. Because I know
possible.
Sam's Club is not expanding at all.
Ours was also verbal, and we received it from one of the leasing agents. So where that is, and this is the fun part about real estate.
Yeah.
These things are fluid.
Yeah.
And what happens today may be not happening tomorrow. So
yeah, I was surprised, though, that when I saw the map, that it was not retail-centered on phase two. It was a much more, even some apartments and office and much more mixed use, which surprised me.
Yeah, the context in which this information was given was when I made a phone call to check on how well they were doing with their lease up, and that's when they told me that. So
okay.
We'll see.
So we don't know.
Yeah, we really don't.
Right now it's empty land. It could be anything.
Yeah. It's a possibility.
Yeah. Councilman Kavanaugh.
No.
Oh, okay. Go.
Just to kind of help you understand a little bit better about this competition and synergy, if you were to put a Fry's grocery store and a Safeway or another grocery store across the street, that's competition. But if you put a Fry's grocery store and a discounter like Target or whatever, that creates the synergy. So while there are major retail competitors within the Riverview development currently, there could be some complementary retailers that could be attracted that would actually increase the synergy, making it a strength.
So, I mean, I'm trying to put something that we don't have real clear vision on, which is what is Wrigleyville, and trying to get to what Councilman Fender talked about this unique specialty, and following up on what you said, if there is something like a Chicago-centric entertainment that is not seen in the area right now, mm-hmm. which, you know, based on my conversation with the Cubs, are some of the things they're targeting, although they don't have anything to announce quite yet. But if there was something that was very, very unique, that was Chicago or Cubs-centric in there, that would sort of fit the kind of scenario you're talking about. Versus if you wanted to put in another national chain, let me back up. That would create the kind of scenario you're talking about where they would draw upon each other. They would create that synergy.
Correct.
Whereas if you're going in there to put another chain food outlet in, which you can find both at Riverview and at Tempe Marketplace, that might have the competitive dilution that you're talking about.
Exactly.
Is that okay? So you agree with that?
Great summary.
Okay.
Yes. So the abundance of retailer restricts the number of new retailers that you could attract into that center. Once again, fewer potential retailers. Vacancy around the area is a weakness, as there are still some vacant square footage in both Tempe Marketplace and Riverview. It creates competition, as Todd mentioned. That lease space, for the retailer, it can be a positive, but for the developer and possibly the city, it would typically be a weakness. Any questions on the Riverview? That was a quick summary overview.
Yeah.
Councilmember Higgins?
You kind of touched on it, but I still don't see, you make a couple statements about drawing revenue from Tempe, Scottsdale, and Phoenix at this location. And you also talk about the different kinds of restaurants at both sites, that Riverview tends to be more drive-thrus and that there's more, what's your exact wording, specialty dining at Tempe Marketplace. So I just don't get, with all the, well, actually I haven't been to Tempe Marketplace, so I can't say what's actually all there, but from what you imply, what can you put at Riverview that's going to, people aren't going to just go, oh, we'll just go down the street to Tempe Marketplace. What makes a site think we're going to draw people from Scottsdale and Tempe and Phoenix to stay at that or come to that location? I don't see it with the stuff that's in the area.
Well, as we talked about earlier, there are, if you're talking about food or restaurant type establishments, there are other formats that would complement what already exists that isn't necessarily a fast food or that are national chains that could be attracted to this site that would be a complement. Now, that's kind of a second phase of this whole process. Actually targeting who would fit best in this group of retailers.
Well, we already have an example there. The challenge with this study is, as you said in the beginning, is this is a foundation, and we're making big leaps as though we're planning out Wrigleyville, and we can't do that.
Right.
Because the whole concept is that it is something unique. We don't know what that, as you define, we don't know what that uniqueness is. But we already have an example in Riverview. You got Toby Keith's. It's not a chain. I mean, there's, what, four of them in the country. It's not viewed as a chain. You can't find one in Peoria. You can't find one in North Scottsdale. And I would guess, in talking to Toby Keith, they are a regional draw. You have people who come in from Scottsdale and from Tempe, and they attract the kind of acts and the kind of difference that a national chain doesn't. They are not the same as what you find all the way around. And so they do draw from a more regional, whereas, and, you know, Mata's in its own way. You know, there are people who drive from far north Mesa to go to the new Mata's at Riverview. They would not drive that for a national chain because it is unique. How do we apply that to Riverview? I don't know. I mean, I can envision some things. Like I said, I know there are some Chicago-specific and Wrigleyville in Chicago-specific entities that the Cubs are talking to. They've mentioned those to us. It's way too early for them to announce that they have a commitment, but I can see those things creating a kind of uniqueness that would differentiate. And like I said, we already have that example at a Riverview, just like you do at other places where it's one of a kind. You mentioned Bass Pro. You know, my guess is that if you didn't have a Cabela's over in Glendale, that you'd get a lot of more people from the West Valley driving clear over for Bass Pro. Now they can go to Cabela's, so that's an example on both ways. They still drive from Scottsdale and from Tempe to go to Bass Pro because it is, as you said, perceived as a very unique thing. So, you know, I guess I'm getting to where Councilmember Fenter was, is that on one hand, this information is very, very is very meaningful in the sense that it does identify the strengths and weaknesses in the retail environment you talked about, which is your standard generic retail environment. You know, it's a little tough for us, and we shouldn't be going too far in detail planning on behalf of the Cubs, their Wrigleyville. But on the other hand, we need to make that jump to try and envision how that regional draw would work. And that's, you know, that's a challenge. But on the other hand, we do have examples. Higgins, I'm sorry. I was quoting Alex, and I was looking at you. That's all right. Hey, you.
So we have 2.6 million square feet of retail in the area. You know, and I know you say you don't know how much you're going to add, but how much can, I mean, when you just think of that number, how much would even be enough to warrant the investment in that area? You know, I can't see it, but I can't see lots of stuff sometimes. So, I mean, this isn't my gig, right? I'm not a real estate developer.
Well, I think it goes back to the uniqueness factor. If it's a unique type of shopping experience for the consumer, it will add, you could add a lot of space. If it's just another of the same old, it won't, you shouldn't add anything.
So let me just ask. So Toby Keith's, I mean, it's a regional draw. However, it hasn't made that strip successful right outside its door. So, you know, my concern with that, sure, people come to Toby Keith from all over the valley because it's a great place, awesome hamburgers, and good entertainment. But, you know, are they walking out the front door to shop somewhere else? So is this same kind of thing going to happen across the street? Sure, it's a regional draw, but the patron that comes to a game or goes to eat at, you name it, regional draw, they don't go anywhere else. So we've added one more restaurant in the city. So those are my concerns. You know, when we look at stuff we currently have, it doesn't have the synergy to develop out the area. Well, you know, Riverview still is newish, but you would think that, you know, those regional draws would have some kind of synergy right on their own block, and it doesn't seem to be doing that just yet. So that's my
concern. I think the mayor has brought up a good point. If the intention is to try to fill in more categories, retail categories, that could be a little bit difficult because the categories are already well served in this quadrant. When you take Riverview and Tempe together, and you got, as a means of comparison, we're talking about 2.6 million square feet between the two of them. And to compare that
hey,
to
Tom,
another,
put that in perspective. 2.6 million.
Let me do that. Okay. Let's compare it to another great regional position. Let's talk about Mills Mall at I-10 and I-60. That's 1.2 million.
So it's basically two regional malls.
Yes. So this is now, and see, this is a good news bad news situation. The good news is, it's poised for the future to be a phenomenal pull, a regional pull for this entire valley. It just is. And as the mayor's brought up very well, I mean, Toby Keith's is, I mean, that was quite a coup for them to get that. That was major. Now, if they can pull a few more like those over across the street into where the Cubs plan on building their facility, that could do what they want to do. That's an if.
But you're still, I think you're ignoring the fact that even though Toby Keith is a regional draw, it hasn't actually taken the springboard for that whole area that you would hoped it to be. So saying that a regional draw is going to make a center vibrant is a sentence in a paragraph. It's not necessarily reality.
Right, and that's a difficulty.
But isn't that a circular argument? What you're arguing is that Toby Keith's been incredibly successful, but it hasn't created something else that's incredibly successful. What if another Toby Keith went in next to Toby Keith's? Wouldn't that create the same situation?
Well, that's what you're saying, and I don't understand this argument at all. That is what you're saying. That's why I'm questioning.
We're trying to make a leap and trying to envision or plan Wrigleyville when really, you know, it's not our investment plan, but we need to, I guess what I'm trying to get from this is an understanding that this entire concept where the Cubs or the Ricketts will come in and make a multi-million dollar investment, is there a scenario that it could succeed? And I think what we're seeing is in each of these situations, we look at the weaknesses they're going to have to identify. And if they cut the check and take the risk, they're going to have to overcome some obstacles to be successful, which if they can pull the multiple Toby Keiths and they can utilize their brand to do that, the question is, could they be successful? What I'm hearing is under the right scenarios, even though you're not making specific suggestions, you're saying, sure, yeah, here are the obstacles they'll have to overcome. Here are the natural built-in advantages they have for when they make that decision. So I can see that without having to put a specific use into a specific slot. I don't even know how much retail space they want to put in there. You know, you say 2.6 million. What if it's only 40,000 square feet of specialty retail, which includes three major residents, and that's what Wrigleyville is.
And they don't know themselves.
Yeah,
they've said 100,000, 200,000 feet. They're not sure.
And the other thing is that the reality that we have to deal with is that while Wrigleyville is the difference, this is the reason why we're creating this whole scenario. At the end of the day, Wrigleyville is not going to be the major shopping area in the city of Mesa. It will not be the difference that will balance our budget. It's unique because it makes the entire complex doable. It's unique because it keeps the Cubs in Mesa. I mean, that's the reality of it. And whether it's 30,000 or 300,000, even at 300,000 square feet, which is more than what you're saying, that's not going to create this boom for us. What it does do is that it makes the Cubs staying in Mesa viable, feasible. And I guess that's, and I know that's a hard bridge to get over. But I appreciate the information that tells us they might have a better opportunity to succeed in this area if we do envision it as somehow creating this unique scenario, because the Cubs can draw upon some unique amenities or brands or specialty stores or whatever it is. The Cubs have the ability to do that because of the brand. We don't know exactly what that is, but we have to assume that they're going to make the investment that will draw those people, because that's their greatest chance for success. That's what I'm hearing here. Whether it be downtown or Riverview, it's going to have to, if they draw another chain store in either place, and I'm sure it'll be the same thing up in when we get to the Wrecker site, then it's just another center. So
that's a perfect explanation. This is a very preliminary study, and I think some of the questions that are being asked are really, they're almost for the next level or even further level. Tenant mix is a really tricky business, and there are many ways to approach tenant mix and get the optimum value and the best scenario. And each of these presents a different perspective. Each site has a different strength and weaknesses for different tenants. You will be able to attract one tenant in one of the sites, but they won't look at the other site because of its strengths. And so this preliminary report basically gives just a real basic foundation for retailers to look at.
Great.
Moving on to any other questions before we move on to Wrecker?
You got anything else?
No.
Okay.
The Wrecker site at southwest corner of East Thomas Road and North Wrecker Road is right there off the 202. This has a fairly large 20-minute drive time because of access. The primary trade area, however, is somewhat limited because the Superstition Springs is to the south, Dana Park is to the south. You have competing shopping centers surrounding the site to the south. Access is a strength due to the freeway access, and it has excellent on-off close by. Retail synergy is a weakness. There's not a lot of retail surrounding this particular site. You have to go a mile or so, even more, to get to any major retailers. Traffic counts on the surface streets are a weakness. There are only 6,800 on the surface streets. However, there are 70,000 people that drive past on the freeway. So that creates an opportunity. But as it stands right now, the people who drive those surface streets, that's a weakness.
Isn't that sort of a chicken and an egg kind
of? It is. You put the right retail.
If there's nothing there, they're not driving anything.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. That could easily turn into a positive if there was retail that pulled people off the freeway.
Question I have, in your experience, does the side of the freeway in this situation, if you don't feel comfortable making this determination, I've always heard that freeways in many ways are considered barriers also. People don't like driving from one side of a freeway to another, even on a surface street. It's an intimidation factor. Would that have an impact on the potential on either site? Because, you know, there's really nothing to the north. I mean, record dead ends, basically, at Thomas. It filters into a neighborhood street. And then there's nothing to the north of that. Does the freeway act as both a deliverer and also a barrier to those people who live south of the freeway to cross over and use this?
It can be a psychological barrier. Really depends on the retailer.
Gotcha.
It really does.
So someone may drive across that freeway to get to a Target, but they may not drive across for just a 99-cent store or something like that.
Correct.
Which is not considered to be more a regional type of a thing.
Correct.
Okay.
The visibility is a weakness, as the freeway at this point is is lower than the grade, is below grade. Retail competition is a strength, as there isn't a lot out there. So once again, it's kind of opposite the synergy. You don't have the retailers to compete. So there's almost a world of opportunity for who could be attracted to this site as far as retailers go. Vacancy is also a strength, as there really isn't a lot of vacancies in the area. With that, we'll just quickly look at the demographic comparisons. They're in the report.
Yeah.
Questions?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead, Dean.
You had mentioned on page 71 that the housing growth is limited in its fill-in type, except you neglected Mountain Bridge, which is within your five-mile circle area, which has about 800 houses going in now. And you also neglected the Val Vista and the 202 property, which was just on today's agenda, about 1,000 houses going in. So those are two pretty huge, good-sized developments where you say housing.
He'll get to this, but we do see this as the best of the areas as it relates to future growth.
I just thought of, and you didn't mention Red Mountain anywhere. You mentioned Lascendes, so I don't want to offend anybody in Red Mountain.
Well,
by just mentioning Lascendes,
you don't have to worry about that.
I know.
We're offending the people in Red Mountain.
I know.
Without even trying.
Let me just say this from a developer standpoint. That is growth.
But when a developer looks at growth within an area, you know, a few thousand houses really is fairly nominal. They, you know, developers like to look at areas that are putting in, you know, have the opportunity to do 2, 3, 4, 5,000 homes at a time. That's really where you get tenants excited. So yes, there, you're absolutely right. There is some growth here, and we reference that in the report, but it's not what we call significant growth.
And then the other question I have is you call out the Longbow site in a paragraph on page 73 as the northeast corner of Higley and McDowell, and it's not really the northeast
well,
corner.
Well, it's kind of in between McDowell and.
So I just want to make sure you you knew where
we,
it was.
We know the site. Yeah, I mean, I live there. I know where the site is. I didn't know exactly where on the site that you're considering, but we are very familiar with
it's
the golf course.
It's probably more like the southwest corner of the 202 and Wrecker Road would have been a better description.
And that's great. It doesn't
or you could have said it's north of the northwest corner of the southeast quadrant of the northeast part
of
the city.
That's what we should have said.
Yeah. You couldn't actually say that. That was incorrect, that. But that's okay.
By the way, welcome to the district system where our council members know their districts very well.
Yeah, well, they're to be congratulated. That's great.
All right, great.
Well, you can see right on the screen that the population growth from 2000 to 2015, the Wrecker site by far exceeds the other two in population growth. So there is a lot of potential for additional sales, retail sales there.
Councilman Richards.
This was one thing that I wanted to clearly understand. Are you projecting this based on shrinking family sizes and aging population? So like kids grow up and leave the neighborhood and... Is that kind of the shrinking population?
You're referencing the downtown and Riverview trade areas,
right?
Which is negative. There's a lot of contributing factors to that. Those are among the contributing factors to a negative population. They can turn around significantly within just a short time. You can see it in a lot of urban renewal projects throughout the nation, where they take a shrinking residential area and revitalize it, and it turns the population growth statistics around. Right now, this is trending. It's trending that way because that's the way it's been for the past 10 years.
But to follow with what Dave said, I mean, you look at Dobson Ranch, for example. I don't know what the actual population numbers are, but still an extremely nice area, well-kept. And yet my guess is, well, the schools tell you that. That the population of Dobson Ranch is much less than it was 15 years ago, even though it's not a blighted area, Dobson Ranch itself.
Right. We're a victim of our own success, our neighborhood.
Yeah, people aren't moving out, and you got kids that are moving out.
Parents don't leave when their kids are all gone,
yeah,
which is why Fiesta Mall, nobody's there buying school clothes anymore. You know.
And so that's an interesting phenomenon, is that area, even though it's still an extremely nice area, also has, Mesa Schools will tell you, that the most rapid drop in school-age children. So the area population is at best stabilized, at worst it's going down because the kids are moving out. And it seems like that's a natural thing in all of West Mesa.
Persons per household goes down, although I checked the three primary trade areas are almost identical at about 2.8 to 2.9 persons per household, which means family size is pretty similar. But my guess is the downtown and Riverview are experiencing a reduction in family size, while possibly the Wrecker area is
my guess is that
is increasing in family size, or at least
I've always wondered which one is the 0.8 member of your family, Dave, that's in the household.
That would be one-year-old.
The 1 year old.
She's not pulling her weight yet.
Okay.
This shows the household trends and the family household status of each of the areas. The income summary, and all these statistics are in the report. The Wrecker site has by far the highest median and average and per capita household income. Just so you know, 2009 is reported because income is only reported once a year annually in December. That's the latest statistic we can get. Education. Downtown and Wrecker have very similar education profiles. Downtown and Riverview, while Wrecker has a higher education college percent of college degrees, 35 versus roughly 25 for the other two. And the strength and weakness matrix highlighted weaknesses red and strengths in green. You'll see some of the demographic components are not highlighted at all. We don't consider them necessarily a weakness or a strength. They are what they are. Retailers will look at them. Some of them use them significantly. Others don't really care. Really depends on the retailer. Any questions for this particular? This is a summary of a matrix of what we just went through.
Yeah. Okay.
We thank you for the opportunity and time.
Well, I have not on page 10.
Not on that. Councilmember Higgins.
Well, let me tell you what some of my problems were just with the, I had a problem on page 1, okay, of the executive summary.
Oh, I thought you had a problem. Page 1 was the picture.
No. Well, actually, yeah, I could have been. No, I'm just kidding. And the reason is you talked about the major private employers in the city. However, you know, this is an up-to-date list. I don't know where you got these from, but, you know, TRW hasn't had more than 100 people working in a long time. So I looked at this, and I'm like, well, that's not right. And then so it kind of jaded all my numbers, which I looked at in detail because, no offense, but you don't have the right major employers on the front page. So then I'm like, well, where did you get your numbers from? And I kind of
these came
there.
From the city.
They came from the Economic Development Department.
No. So I find that hard to believe because we know that TRW hasn't had more than 100 people in a long time.
I mean, Bill and his staff gave that information to the TRW on the south.
Pardon me?
TRW.
Yeah, Jermaine, District 6? Yeah, it hasn't had more than 100 people in a while.
Well, I think there's certainly within here that list, there are significant private employers that are listed.
Absolutely.
Here.
But so, and then the, you know, another one of these I looked up and, you know, there's people in Mesa, but there's more people in Phoenix, you know. So it kind of threw me off and then I just wondered where all the numbers came from.
Well, we were working with your economic development people on that and that's where we got that.
The statistics on each of the sites, however, as far as establishments and employees, come from our data vendor, which provides us the demographic information. So they're not connected to that information. So when you look at the establishments and employees, that's from a quarterly update that he does on every year.
Okay, thanks.
Anything else?
Okay, anything else? So the summary that we talked about a little bit before, would you agree with that? Our biggest challenge, once again, is trying to take this and read more into it than what is there. But on the other hand, it's good to have the base information because it explains to us as we try and combine, at least to me, as we try to combine what the Cubs will come back with, and they tell us that pretty soon they're going to come back with some more specifics on their specifics on their plans, that we can at least put them into context with the overall environment. I mean, is that an accurate? As we look at whether this is an investment, this is what we want to move forward. But once again, we're not pursuing this whole thing so we can build a Wrigleyville. We're building a Wrigleyville. We're allowing the Cubs to invest in Wrigleyville so we can keep them in Mesa. And that's, I understand how that's sort of a difficult bridge to get over. But that at the end of the day, and I think it was Councilmember Richens at one time, basically said that's the exercise. Yeah. It's good to know, though, the three different sites, because site is so important, not only to us, but to the voters of Mesa, to understand where the opportunities and the challenges are with each of the sites and try and match that with what we envision with what Wrigleyville and the whole stadium complex and with what the Cubs come back to us and tell us their vision is. I'm sure they're looking at the same data and they've have their experts, Mr. Scholl, who's you know, West Corvette and knows the market pretty well. I'm sure they're looking at these same things to try and plug some of these gaps that we're talking about and trying to identify those specific opportunities that will work best in a Wrigleyville environment. So, I mean, so thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Okay. Next item on the agenda is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide council-wide, not singular, direction on the zoning code updates.
Do you want to stretch or something?
Okay, let's take 5 minutes.
I know how zoning can be bigger.
10 till. That'll be like 8 minutes.
Zoning's more...
So we'll begin again at 10 till. Okay. We can all take our seats. We're going to talk about something completely different. We're going to talk about zoning. So Gordon, tell us how zoning applies to Wrigleyville.
I was quite a segue there, Mayor. Actually, I was thinking that maybe I need to take a trip to Chicago and understand Wrigleyville entirely so we can write the appropriate regulatory scheme to facilitate the entire development, and we can build that into the zoning code update.
With his own credit card.
Just a thought. Where do I go from here? We're talking to you about the zoning ordinance update. We've been working on this for 4 years. We're trying to wrap it up and get to a final draft so that we can start advertising that and going through the adoption process. I show this again. This is kind of our mantra. We're trying to balance the various aspects of the code between land use, impact, and form. And real quickly, what our schedule has been. Last week, we talked to you a little bit about development standards. This week, I'll talk to you about land uses and districts. Particularly, I'd like to compare this to the present code as opposed to, because we've been talking about this for a long time. So some of the items that we've talked about along the way, I kind of want to get confirmation on before we get into the final draft. And then next week, I'll talk to you a little bit about administration and processing. The first thing, compared to the major code, the major revisions in the single residence, first one I'd like to talk to you about is accessory living quarters. This was a program that was adopted by the City Council in 1988. It's in the present ordinance. Right now, one of the six criteria includes something that says these accessory living quarters shall not be leased or rented. The idea is that they're mother-in-law's quarters. One of the proposals in this particular document is to take accessory living quarters and delete the not leased or rented requirement, which basically would allow these to be rented out as separate units by folks. One of the experiences that we've had from an enforcement standpoint is that once the accessory living quarters is adopted and once it's constructed and the mother-in-law has lived there for a while and has gone on to the rest home or wherever, then you have this construction. Apparently, I'm too colloquial.
I think there's I think there's others who are thinking that they went on to somewhere besides the rest home. Is that the deal? You're morbid. The great condo in the sky.
But you have this investment. The family is invested in this extra addition on there, and they're kind of wondering what they can do with it. To a certain extent, they might be able to use it for a member of their family, a college student or something along that line, so they might have separate quarters. But the temptation is, quite frankly, to lease it out to somebody else. And it's a very difficult thing to try to enforce. Folks, you know, it's so the question is.
Well, let me ask you this. If the space is there, it's usable, and it was used for one purpose, why do we care if they lease it out?
That's kind of the point. We have folks who have a perception that if you have these garage apartments or mother-in-law's quarters or granny flats, depending upon what you want to call them, that you're no longer having a single-family neighborhood. You're creating a multifamily dwelling
but
on that property.
Isn't it technically a multifamily if you have granny or mother-in-law there?
Well, it depends upon what you do. It gets into the definition of what constitutes a legal residence. From the planning standpoint, we think that these are, quite frankly, they do provide another method of affordable housing for folks. They do provide extra income for folks, especially folks as they're beginning to age. It provides an extra income for that. In addition to that, it's a relatively minor impact.
That's the deal. I mean,
In the adjacent neighborhood. Now, there are people who disagree with that, but from the planning staff standpoint, we feel that it's a reasonable thing to drop this particular requirement.
Councilmember Higgins.
Yeah, I have a real problem with that because, you know, you rent out the space to another family who might have like 2, 3, 4 more cars in the neighborhood, and all of a sudden now what was a single family home is, you know, like you say, a multi-resident area. And in some areas you might not notice that, like if you got 1, 2 acre lots already, but in other areas, I think it's too big of an impact, and it's not something we want to open up to having rental property in people's backyards and, you know, our whatever districts.
One of the things that we did in making this is that of the six criteria, one of the six criteria was that the maximum size of the accessory living quarters could be half the size of the dwelling. We reduced that to 30% of the size of the dwelling. So if you have, for example, a dwelling that's 1,800 square feet, the maximum size of the accessory dwelling unit can only be 600 square feet, which is basically it's a room, a bedroom, and possibly a walk-in kitchen.
But that doesn't mean a family of six might not live there. I mean, let's be realistic. I mean, people live in a lot of small places. So to assume that just because it's small, more people aren't going to go in, I think it could be a detriment to a lot of neighborhoods in Mesa. So just that's I'm not a proponent of this, just so you know. You're not done, and I'm sorry, but
we're bringing this up because we talked about this a couple of different times. We kind of skimmed over it a little bit, but when we get into the final draft, we're trying to make sure. I mean, some of these things we understand. There may be people who may disagree with the direction we're going. We're just trying to get confirmation from the council that this is indeed what you want to see in the final draft when we do this. We think there are valid reasons for doing that. You've certainly brought up reasons that we may not want to do this. We need to find what the direction of the council is so we get to the final document.
You're looking at me.
I'm
thank you,
you know, last meeting you looked away from me. Now you're looking at me.
Caught me dead in the tracks.
Councilmember
Richards. We're all waiting for somebody to say something. I've seen this successfully done. There's a few Western cities that have actually done this kind of thing that's really revitalized neighborhoods because of the added values that you've added, added values that have been allowed because of this accessory living quarter. We have a issue in West Mesa right now that, like on my street, for example, we have five original homeowners that built those homes in the 60s, and we were talking about Dobson Ranch and the population turnover down there, where you've had all the children grow up and leave and not buy school clothes and not repopulate the schools in the area. This is a mechanism that starts to temper that kind of big bell curve that happens when you start to allow these kind of things. You end up with the 90-year-old couple that lives next door to me, you know, either has somebody that, you know, they build one of these, they live in there, and then their kids and their family live in the front house. And so you're able to start having a little bit more of flexibilities. I know people that have a college student, they want a certain amount of autonomy to be able to go to school. We're in West Mesa, at least, we're really near ASU. And so you can start having that college student isn't in the house, but is of the house, you know. So I think we should look at this or continue to look at including it in our zoning code. And really look at the best practices across the West, which I presume you already have, if you've included this at all. Austin, Texas, comes to mind as a community that did this rather successfully. I think there's a place for it in our code. And, you know, maybe we need to make considerations for minimum lot size that it's allowed on, parking issues that need to be resolved. You know, there's ways, if there's on-street parking is a big issue. Somebody sent me a note about, you know, banning on overnight parking on the street, you know, between 10 and 4, you know, so you start to minimize that kind of issue. So I think there's ways to do it successfully. I would really push to continue to include this, as I know that it's, you know, I'm 10 years away from having a college student, and I also know that my mother-in-law may end up needing to come and stay with us someday, and so it's a consideration we've talked about in our remodeling plans for the future as well. So.
Vice Mayor?
Elsewhere in the city code has to do with how many properties you can lease. If it's just a single residence and they just have that one accessory living quarters and it's not considered a business, just the one, but I mean, if you have multiples, it's a whole different ballgame. But a single residence should not be a challenge to us.
These are more studio or one bedroom apartments.
Right.
This the way we just were describing this when we were talking about this was this Fonzie living above the garage.
Most of them it's a studio or one bedroom at the max, and some of them don't even have full kitchens.
Correct.
But again, it's simply for them to do rental on a property like that. Is it's a single thing? It's a whole different issue. I don't see a problem as long as it doesn't interfere with the neighborhood.
Well, and I think Councilmember Higgins raised some good points, but once again, government, we tend to overregulate for the exception that rarely happens. We have a tendency to throw the baby out with the bathwater all the time because we're afraid of that one exception. And it seems like there's other means to deal with the one exception. If you don't want 10 college students living in this one room, well, parking, for example. You can talk about the, our code doesn't allow parking on non-paved surfaces. It doesn't, if we go with things where we control parking in streets and things like that, well, by doing that, you can address the real problem. The real problem isn't that there's 6 or 8 people in there. The real problem is the byproduct of those 6 or 8 people, the additional cars, the parking in the front yard, the parking on the street, 3 or 4 of those. And it seems to me like there are things that we can do that would still allow the activity and would cover 98-99% of the cases and still handle that 1% extreme, which does create neighborhood problems. And we don't have to do it by eliminating the whole activity. We can do it by controlling the
items like parking,
the isolated, because the problem isn't that people are living there. The problem is that they bring their cars and their other stuff with them. And so why do we deal with people living there? Why don't we deal with the other one? Councilmember?
Could an HOA say no?
Sure.
To something like this? Could they ban it within their own? So some of our neighborhoods that are regulated by HOAs could say.
I suspect that they could, yes. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. Alex.
Thank you, sir. This is going to be contrary to my normal core values of, you know, highest and best use kind of things. Having had a home on a large acre with an outbuilding, mother lived there until she passed away. It was a wonderful experience, and the different scenarios that Councilmember Richens mentions, I get completely. I would not support changing a single-family neighborhood into a duplex type of situation. We talk about the parking. Well, we can address the parking in that. I look over at Dan and think of the wonderful conversations of how I've not been able to deal with parking issues in neighborhoods because it is a huge can of worms of trying to regulate and sticker and permit and just a mess. We've never been able to kind of get through to that. So I would not support personally encourage or support changing a single family neighborhood to a whole area of duplexes for a rental or earn money. But again, I realize I'm hypocritical on part of that, so it's just my experience. If I look at Mesa, is the place I want to go more fourplexes, more duplexes in this community? That would be the place I definitely don't want to go as a policy maker.
Well,
just
Dave.
I understand the point there. The phrase, the operative phrase here is accessory living quarters, not apartments. You're not proliferating apartment uses or turning single family homes into duplexes because that's a multifamily use. But accessory living quarters, by its definition, is different. So, you know, typically, is it not detached or is it attached?
Could be.
The majority should be attached. There'll be occasional detached items, but they have to be built within the buildable area of the lot. They have to maintain the same setbacks as the primary house.
I'm still trying to get the difference between having your mother-in-law who has a car and having a college student that has a car. I guess I'm missing that, because if we're looking at neighborhood consequences, what's the difference? You know, the different to me. I know for the family, there's a difference between having your mother-in-law out there, but from our standpoint, when we're looking at neighborhood consequences, I was trying to understand the difference. Because it's only it's a studio,
Your analysis is the same analysis the staff came up with. The parking impact would be relatively the same. If there is a concern about parking, we can certainly add a requirement that says if you have an accessory living quarters, they have to add an on-site parking place. That's not a difficult thing to add.
Dina and then Alex.
I think what happens is we take a single family residence neighborhood where we can't run a business out of it currently, and we take it into a business making opportunity. I have no problem with having your kids obviously live in the apartment out back, or mother-in-law, or church friends' kids, or kids from out of wherever you want, but as long as it's not a money making operation.
Okay, so if your son gets married and his wife comes in, we would preclude them from paying
you
rent.
No, not at all, because what we're saying is, I'm saying I don't want it to become a rental property.
But so you're saying that your son and his wife, who gets married, cannot
sure
pay you
can.
Rent?
No. No. Correct.
You're saying they can't.
They can't. Correct. Because then it becomes a business making.
So you would say
operation.
That in a 600 square foot studio living that your grandmother lived in,
mm-hmm.
she passed away, that you would say that the city would regulate and say you cannot have your kids live out there.
No, they can live out there, but they can't give me money for it, because now it becomes a business, and we've changed a single family residence into a money making operation where we can't build stuff. Like I say, we can't have a business out of our home today,
okay.
and that becomes a business.
I think that's a
stretch.
No,
Alex.
Well, here's what we're dealing with in District 2, and I haven't had a chance to come over to Gordon's office this week and deal with it, but duplexes north of University.
Would you guys please get together before these meetings so we know what we can do?
Well, you know, when you and I appreciate that, Mary. It's just when you get chewed out by folks north of University, west of Greenfield, or excuse me, west of Higley, kind of in an area, we have a whole strew of duplexes. And what has functionally happened is that the parking occurs in the front yards. But I think in the code, we do not have a provision that allows or requires folks in fourplexes and other kind of, you can't park in the front yard. In your home, you can't, you know, unless you put an all-weather surface and different things. It's just it's a challenge, and I've seen how that neighborhood has changed. You know, I'm not doing a good job of describing it. You know, when you mentioned for rental property, I'm at home with my family. I have an auxiliary building, or I have a place for other family members to live. I have pride of ownership. I'm going to make sure that place stays nice. I'm connected to the neighbors. At what point does a homeowner step away or move to Utah or something to a summer home, and now that becomes a rental?
Well, but
rental.
You're talking about a different scenario. I mean, but I think what we're saying is correct. If you have a dual rental, that's different than if it's an accessory living, where the primary resident, the family lives in it, and they have an extra room. That's a totally different scenario than both the ones you're talking about.
Well,
because you're not talking about a series of fourplexes. You're talking about a situation that doesn't exist that often. I mean, how many houses do we know in my neighborhood? You know, there's 28 houses. There might be one house or two houses that have an accessory living area. And I agree with you that this should be where the primary residence, the family lives there, and it's just something that they are doing that you wouldn't have. Oh, good, we're going to rent to two families now, and you turn it into a. I agree with that scenario.
Yeah, I think therein might lie.
I think Dave has.
I think therein might. Well, I think therein might lie the compromise to this is, you know, if it's owner occupied,
right,
in the primary residence and the accessory living quarters, you can do what you want with it. If
long
you get I agree with Councilmember Finter that the double rental situation that's when it gets proliferated and scary, and you wouldn't want an investor to come in, buy a home, and then add an accessory living quarters, and then all of a sudden you have basically de facto multifamily property. And so I think maybe if we're going to take the step to regulate an accessory living quarters, it's only conforms if the primary home is occupied by the owner and lives there full time.
Well, let me ask you this, if I can just complicate
it. And that way
further.
You keep that pride of ownership.
Yeah, right? No, I'm with you on the pride of ownership. And that I missed that little piece at the beginning, and maybe it was or once it mentioned. How about, I'm trying to think of the right, most modern term that we use, alternative living facility for folks that may have gone through some difficulties in the justice system or
group
whatever.
Home.
Is it can it be a small group home with two folks? Can it be a? I just don't know if we're opening up a can of worms, because there is a revenue source to be generated.
The group home for the handicap scenario that you're talking about, in which people who might be coming out of the justice system and may have a perceived handicap based on past drug abuse or past alcohol addiction. That's entirely different, and that's not necessarily what we're talking about in this particular circumstance. Is strictly the garage above the apartment, or the small room with a kitchen in it that's in the back that might be either attached or semi-detached from the main structure, and it's therefore the term in California is granny flats, and you were talking about Austin. I've seen several California, actually, the California legislature actually passed a requirement that municipalities in that state have to have a provision for these types of granny flat options in California. But that's California. This is Arizona, obviously, very different. The circumstance, though, is that we have an ordinance that makes it it's difficult to enforce. Once we get past the initial option that this is done for the mother-in-law or for the college student, we have that item there, and quite frankly, we have no idea whether it's being leased or rented to somebody else.
Yeah, why is it difficult to enforce?
Because we have no probable cause to go in and
no, but but the question is that why don't we go and enforce it? Because nothing offensive is going on.
Typically.
So why do we care?
Well, that's...
We care when things offensive go on, when people park too much or when there's too many people or when it turns into a true rental unit.
It's typically not noticed.
Well, if it's not noticed, then I guess the point is why would government care? Dina?
Well, and the point is, you know, we can't enforce what you're saying now, the rental in the backyard. How would we enforce the fact that I'm renting the front house and the back house? I mean, it just goes into enforcement again.
Okay, but it gets back to my question. If there's no offensive behavior going on, why would government care?
Well, then it becomes, again, a
duplex.
Okay, but if it does come in, if there's offensive behavior, let's say there's a party or whatever, at that point in time, you have a regulatory scheme to stop the behavior. You can then force the owner to say, well, wait a second, you're not the owner, this is not owner-occupied, this is illegal, boom, you're gone, move out. And then we have a hammer. But if people are living in harmony and there's only two cars there and they are quiet and the neighbors have no idea what's going on, why would government care what's going on there if it doesn't offend anyone else? I agree with setting up a regulatory scenario where if something does rise to the level where it's infringing upon others' rights, we have the hammer to go in and make something happen. But, you know, frankly, I don't care if somebody owns their home and keeps it up and has great tenants and do all that. I don't know that's going on because they're not doing anything that's bad. But I also, if something does bad happen, I would love to have the city be able to go in there and stop it and help me out. Alex.
Well, and following up on, if I can take that argument, in my mind, and I always visit with my libertarian friends, you know, it's always highest and best use, and someone should have any opportunity to do whatever, and I get that. You know, that's kind of my leanings in...
Well, but the problem with the libertarians is that they don't have any option when it becomes offensive.
Well, thank you, and that's my point is, okay, if I buy a home and I expect a certain property value in a single-family neighborhood, and it's allowed to turn into a duplex, and I realize that we're saying, hey, owner-occupied, but if we don't have a... I'm crazy because I'm having to fight, or I'm having to give a side that I don't really believe in, more government, more stuff, but by having a process in place that we know that it's an owner occupied and we know it's, you know, the scenarios that have been put out here and not a group home or something that it's evolved to, I have lost in my mind, and I tell my L friends, you know what, where is my highest and best use? I spent a fortune to get a house in a single family neighborhood, and now I'm living next to a duplex with lots of cars and some challenges, and I have a city government that's reluctant to come in and say, you know what, we don't have the right to intrude.
Well, wait a second. No, you're talking the same exact scenario that Dave and I are talking about, that the government, we would set up a scenario where we'd have the right to go in there and do that.
More government. I know. So to give liberties.
Okay. Let me play a little bit. Yeah. More government to tell you cannot use that, even though you're not going to offend your neighbors?
It's ironic I'm having to argue this point.
You would rather have government lay down the law and says you are precluded from using this because there might be the potential that something bad might happen. We're going to have government come in when government is needed, is that is the time when there is an offensive activity going on.
My point exactly. So why mess with this? I realize it's crazy.
Because we have a situation right now which goes against what you say your principles are. We are precluding an activity which is not offensive to anybody.
Oh, no. And it's offensive.
No. It's only offensive when activities happen.
Mayor, I'm going to have my group from home friends give you a call and let them tell you how offensive. It has the potential.
How do we go from a 600-foot granny flat to a group home?
What is a group home? Two people living in a granny flat that just got out of or on parole for some sort of violations? I mean, again, we can't go in as a government agency.
You can't stop that now.
No. Well, yeah, you know, we're working on things.
Well,
so.
you can't.
Yeah.
Because the question is, are they paying rent? No.
Yeah, they are.
Okay.
Well, with all due respect, this is a fascinating discussion because, number one, right now, I would assume we have thousands of people who are not in compliance with the current code because you have so many homes where they have had that mother-in-law room, the granny flat, whatever you want to call it, which is a very small space that at best two... You have newlyweds who go in there and they might end up with one baby and then they don't have enough room, they got to move out somewhere. Mm-hmm. We have literally a whole lot of those, especially in the west side of town, that are non-conforming right now, that if we really wanted to get nasty, we could go through and we could cite everybody and we could really hurt a lot of people who really count on that little small income from that granny flat that they're renting because they don't have the mother-in-law there anymore for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. We're comparing apples and oranges right here. This discussion has gotten so far out of whack because we're talking about one thing and trying to dump a whole other thing on it, and they're not the same. Mm-hmm. And we've got to be careful how we do that. The mayor has explained very well the difference between how we can regulate if there becomes a problem, but we have no reason to over-regulate for a potential problem, and this discussion has really become interesting because I, with all due respect, I cannot agree with a couple of discussions here because it's apples and oranges.
It's a fun discussion.
Yeah, it's fun. I'm having fun. Since I'm the only one sitting here that's ever done this, I think I can speak from a point of expertise. I have gone through the city process. I have permitted my house to be able to have, you know, the opportunity. Well, let me clarify. I have had an auxiliary building that was built on a house 40 years ago. Had my mother-in-law there. Had a very
How big was the building?
Oh, it was about 1,500 square feet.
Okay, which would not comply with what we're talking about here.
That's not even.
But the portion of living.
I'd have to. It depends upon the size of his house.
Yeah. Okay, so if you have a 4,500 square foot house or more,
that's right.
And if you have 4,500 square foot house, you're on at least half acre to an acre. Okay.
It was a big house, big old house on a big old property. I've since sold it. I've been through it, lived it, loved it. I was responsible, and I've also seen how it doesn't work. And I'm not doing a good job of articulating it, but the last thing we need, and maybe if you're saying, Gordon, that we have the resources and the ability to go through some of this process and make it work, I'm with you. I see the potential problems. All I can say is my highest and best use, I was able to sell that house and another family with a mother-in-law is living there, and it works good. If you turn it into a rental situation and don't have some clear processes in place to make sure it doesn't turn into a duplex in a single-family house, I see that the problem.
And okay, but I don't think you are. I think you're talking the exact scenario that the vice mayor talk about. Number one, how many places in this city do you have 1,500 square foot houses? I mean, I think they're very limited. We're talking mainly about granny flats, 400 to 600 square foot maximum, because that's a 2,000 square foot house. And I mean, believe me, I built a lot of houses with casitas. We call them casitas, artists' lofts, mother-in-law, granny flats, whatever you got. They're the same thing. They either have most of them don't even have a full kitchen. And the reason they don't have a full kitchen is so you don't have two residences sitting there. That's another way to...
That tends to be the deciding factor when these things come in for plan review is the presence of the second kitchen.
Do you have full kitchen?
Do we have the minimum lot size that we're considering accessory?
We have lot coverage. Cut
off your monologue here.
There's lot coverage.
It's just the roof area, it's a comparison of the roof area of the accessory dwelling.
Okay, so even like if you had a 6,000 square foot lot, that's not the deciding factor. It's the house size and the roof unit size.
So it could be a storage room, or it could be a granny flat. And a lot of times, you know, that's the option. Mm-hmm. You know, I've built a lot of houses where you had an attached, and it could either be a big storage room, or with a few extra $1,000. We put plumbing in it, put a bathroom in it, and all of a sudden it's a studio granny flat. Mm-hmm. And people can do that easily. And I appreciate what you're saying, Alec, and I agree with you 100%. I think there are ways, as Councilmember Richens said, that we can handle those situations and then have the regulatory hammer to go in. And one of them is that the primary residence has to be owner-occupied. I mean, you can't turn it into a dual rental thing. I think that if you're looking at the average size, which is probably 400 to 600 square feet in a granny flat, there may be a lot of situations, but, you know, we have, remember, we have 150, 60, 70,000 housing units in the city. So even if it's 4,000 or 5,000, it's not a, it's not an extremely common incident. And the other thing, I think it can be regulated if you look at activity. I've had people who complained in my neighborhood. I went through this with a group home. The neighbors found out there was a group home to a block over, and they all of a sudden became very, very upset and wanted to get rid of it. Well, the interesting thing is that group home had been there for 3 years, and no one had noticed it because they never did anything offensive. And all of a sudden, people found out it was a group home, and now they're up in arms because it's the worst thing in the world. I go, well, where were you 2 years ago? Well, they admitted the people have never done anything to bring. They looked like, as a matter of fact, they were better than the family that lived there before, who had two teenage sons. So I'm very sensitive to the fact that we should have regulatory process to protect people's rights when their neighbors are doing things that damage them. And if they were to turn it into a dual rental unit, I would not support that. But I think if we take a reasonable approach, if we allow the opportunity, but say if you cross the line, like if you move out and you don't own it, you're not owner occupied anymore, that's a clear violation. We don't allow that.
Okay.
But frankly, my thing is that if you're not doing anything that offends your neighbors, why should government care? So I think there is a place that if you cross that line, I would absolutely agree we need to have the regulatory hammer to go in and say, this is, you've crossed the line, and go for that. And there are scenarios which we clearly state will create that. If it becomes a duplex rental, I agree with you. The odds are if you have a duplex rental, it's a very short trip from regular living to that, because pride of ownership is gone, the control, natural control is gone, and I would say that the propensity is that's a bad situation, and we should be able to go in and hammer that. So, Dina.
But Mayor, we don't have a current system in place where we know if somebody's living in their house or not. Other states actually have what, rental permits, registration. So if I'm renting my house, it's registered, and you know that I'm not the primary owner. We don't do that in the state of Arizona.
There are licensing requirements when you have. I believe it's two or three.
Well, once again, the question is, though.
But see, this is the thing, though. You know, this actually doesn't actually affect most of my district. I'm more concerned with the older areas of Mesa, which could end up sliding really quickly in decline with this type of activity.
And just so I understand where you're coming from, why can't we regulate the sliding into decline? I mean, once again, if it's not sliding into decline, do we have an interest in it?
Well, I mean, if we're going to say you can use your property as a moneymaker, then we should allow people to have businesses out of their home. You know, we don't do that today. Why not?
So but it gets back to the extraordinary case that I talked about, is that you're saying that I couldn't rent a room to my son and his new daughter and my new daughter-in-law. I could not allow them to live there.
No, they can live there all that you want. You can let them live there
but
forever.
Heaven forbid that they pay for my dinner and that be considered.
Well, see, there you go. That's a whole day, right?
With all due respect,
no, I just totally disagree.
Stay in order here.
Let's
stay in order.
Stay
in order.
This is an interesting discussion.
It is good, and I appreciate your concern for my side of town. With all due respect, those of us who represent this side of town find this to be a potential value for and a potential revitalization tool, not something that's going to help us continue to slide and decline. So I've done a lot of reading and research on the granny flat issue. Gordon and I have been going back and forth on this one for probably 2 years talking about this, and it's something that I feel that could be a real revitalization tool for older areas because of the reinvestment that could occur.
Well, let me see if I can maybe summarize this real quick. I think there is at least a common thread that we're concerned if the use of a property leads to things that are detrimental to the neighborhood. I think where our difference is that when do we arrive at that point? And excuse me, I think there's some valid concerns that by simply allowing the activity, you're really setting the stage for that to happen. Is that accurate to describe what you're in? And I think that's a valid concern. I think others say, hey, listen, let's allow the activity because in the vast majority of the cases, there's never going to be a problem. But let's include some regulatory scheme that says if it does get to the point where, for example, you have the two rentals, that's not acceptable because we recognize that that's now a very that's not, we're now on not only a slippery slope, we're sliding down it real quick. What if we said that we would allow this, but let's come back with some things related to the dual rental. Mm-hmm. Let's come back with some things as it relates to parking, perhaps even number of people. I mean, let's say that, you know, you can have this granny flat.
The number of people we may run into a problem with.
Well, you can figure out with the legal staff as to what we can possibly do. But identify those activities which would create a problem for the neighborhood. I'm still not convinced that the mere fact that we have a young couple living in there is offensive to the neighborhood and creates a problem. Is that something that at least the majority of us can agree on
and give them instruction? And I think Alex's points are really good because the problem I see with this small rental, the duplex, fourplex rental, is off-site, out-of-state landlords that are buying these on inflated cap rates and promises
to turn into a rental unit.
Exactly, and this—that's not the purpose of an accessory living quarters.
No, accessory
I think that's
is
the operative word here that helps us imply that the primary residence is owner-occupied in order for this.
So, if we focus on the fact that it is truly accessory living, it's owner-occupied, therefore it is accessory. Can you come up with a scheme that?
We'll put those.
I'm getting nods from at least four of us here. Is that okay?
Okay.
All right. So that's the direction.
Okay.
No, but thank you for the discussion because I think there was a lot of good points raised there.
We're just confirming these things.
Yeah. So let's skip to the last slide now.
I'm trying to get off this slide. The next one has to do with the areas that are zoned single residence that front onto arterial streets. What we've proposed is that through a special use permit process, we would allow small, limited scale retail restaurants and offices to be in single residence without rezoning. They would go through the Board of Adjustment for a special use permit. They would be capped at 1,500 square feet, and they would be required to head to front onto both an arterial and a local street. So it's not just the houses that front onto an arterial street, they would have to be at a corner. So the idea basically is that those houses that are directly impacted by the what used to be the farm road has now become the six-lane arterial street in front of them. They run across this. Their house is no longer viable for residential use. They're trying to change it to an alternative use. Rezoning seems to be a perceived barrier to that. We're trying to facilitate the alternative use through a public process.
So as right now, you know, for example, you look at University, Stapley, Broadway, Southern, where you've turned a lot of these big houses into offices.
Correct.
What we're saying is it would simply expand that, and we would say that, you know, as long as it doesn't exceed 1,500 square feet, they could also have a small little retail or a restaurant or something like that.
Correct.
You're really expanding on, you're not creating a new...
The on-site impacts would have to be accounted for, so they have to provide on-site parking, on-site, you know, those types of things.
Okay.
But it would be basically through the Board of Adjustment. The fees are typically a little lower. It's a little bit quicker process. There would still be a public review. We would still have posting. We would still notify neighbors. We would still have a public discussion. It wouldn't go through P&Z and council.
Gotcha. Okay. Dina.
I have a problem with this, too. Okay. I just see that this is, you know, if you use those couple examples you did, like, what did you say, University? Southern Avenue, where you had these nice big homes, and now they're now no longer residences. Again, it's just a decline in the neighborhood. And if we were now to, we'll take Val Vista, where there's nothing but big houses north of Brown, if all those, you know, not that they're going to, but I mean, change the character of that neighborhood hugely if all of a sudden we can now start niching away and making it commercial. So I don't see this as a benefit anywhere. I mean, unless you can.
I would suspect, I don't know this for certain, but I suspect the houses that are along Val Vista, north of Brown Road, are probably, the roof area alone is probably over 3,000 square feet, and which would be larger than the scale that we're talking about here. We're talking about 1,500 square feet. This is like smaller than some starter homes.
But are you talking about the whole home can't be bigger than that, or the area that they wish to develop?
The commercial activity would be not larger than 1,500 square feet.
Right, so that means
so
I could
be
have
a residence also.
Right, so I could have the 5,000 square foot roof area and have a 1,500 square foot carved out retail space in it.
Yes.
No, well, wait.
Okay.
Time out, though. But we're skipping. Wouldn't they have to have, they'd have to go through a rezone?
No.
Right now, they have to go through rezone. This would be the special use permit. Yes.
Okay. So they'd have to go through a process. Let me, rather than say rezone, they'd have to go through a process.
Yes.
A posted process and this then. Okay. To get that. Vice Mayor?
That was going to be my question. That's how we got to where we were along University. They had to rezone each of those properties along University for the uses they're doing.
Correct.
And what we're talking about now is the same scenario on a major arterial, not have to go through the zoning process to change it?
They wouldn't have to go to P&Z and City Council.
They go to Board of Adjustment.
They would go to Board of Adjustment through a special use permit.
I'm not so sure.
Dave?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I want to completely give up council regulatory authority on this one, but I do see the need here as well because I'm with Dina. I'm a little torn on this one. A lot of my neighbors have been concerned about creeping commercial uses on arterials, especially when they are part of a residential neighborhood. On the flip side of that, some of these residential homes are not viable to raise children in, or I mean, they're only good for rentals and only a very small niche of the rental market because you have 72,000 cars a day going in front of the street, and so you have to figure out how to balance here. And if we can come up with a regulatory scheme that enables a fairly robust neighborhood conversation about the use, that I would feel comfortable with this one.
How about this
going forward? But
it would seem like we could be able to identify an area as being acceptable for these kind of activities. You follow what I'm saying? For example, if the council agreed or someone came in and said, listen, I'd like to convert this, and let's say it's University between this street and that street. Mm-hmm. Right now there's no businesses. It's an arterial. They're all residentials, residences.
All
but you say, listen, it's going down. You're not going to have that kind of thing come in. And staff came to us and said, council, what if we designate this stretch of road as being open to this type of activity? But someone, if they wanted a specific use, would have to come in and then get a special use permit. That wouldn't come back to council. But at least council had the opportunity to look at the area, get input, and say, okay, that stretch of road is now designated through some other kind of overlay, or
yes.
I don't know what you'd call it.
No, it would be an overlay district.
It would be an overlay, and that would be available. And then if somebody wanted to do the 1,500 square feet, that would protect, for example, Val Vista.
Right.
We'd come in there, and the council would say, no, you know, that just doesn't work for that area because we don't want that area, and the neighbors don't want that area going commercial, and so it wouldn't be open. And we could have a control because then we would rely on the fact that somebody wouldn't go in and through Board of Adjustment change an area without council being involved in that. Which in essence would create a ripple zoning effect, mm-hmm, without us being in there. And I'm worried about that.
Right.
Dave, and then Dina.
Sorry, the majority, I think, of areas that are like this are probably on the west side. There might be a few on the east, but most of the neighborhoods are block walls that front major arterials with the streets that just turn in. And so I think I would feel comfortable going on with this discussion if we, like the mayor suggested, identifying some specific areas that this may be considered.
Okay.
And then we can see what the context is, because it's very specific. And I bet if once we got a map out and we looked at, you know, how many 1,500 square foot houses or smaller floor area houses front or even have more than that, and so you're saying the maximum 1,500 square feet is related to the commercial, so somebody could actually live there and then have some. Okay.
Yeah.
I bet it would be a pretty small stretch of road, maybe 2 or 3, 4 miles worth of road.
It would have limited applicability.
What's that?
So the question is why? Why the change if it's only a small area anyway? Do you want to have go through the planning and zoning process like normal? Because you're saying you want to kind of have council input anyway and just have a different fee structure for them or something. Because that's what I hear you saying. You're trying to make it cheaper for people to do this. So you want to change the you want to go through Board of Adjustment, which in reality you still want to have control. So,
well, are you talking only properties found on a corner?
Yes.
Okay. So you're eliminating even stretches of
mid-block.
The
idea behind the corners is the access question. Particularly the difficulty that we find with the mid-block locations is that typically we try to put the parking behind the setback lines, and the with the house, typically the house is right at the setback line, so to get the parking, you have to get around the house and into the back.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the mid-block locations, typically the house is so close to the property line on the side that it's difficult to get access on the side.
Well, here's how I look at it. I mean, some of the coolest restaurants you go to, you could go along 44th Street and like in India School, what's the name of those restaurants? They're 44th Street is not a major arterial. It's a two-lane road, a wide two-lane road, going north-south there in Phoenix in the Indian School, Thomas area.
Mm-hmm.
And what is propped up along those are some incredibly nice neighborhood restaurants in old residences, and they're on corners. And I think that's a good thing. And I think the reason we're asking this is we want good things to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me like we're trying to overregulate when we should be encouraging good things to happen. Now, those things were done with an eye to not destroying the neighborhood, but if you're on an arterial that has traffic, no one's going to live there. Why would you limit the use of that when you could offer something to the neighborhood that would actually be a huge amenity and would be a step up? And you've got great examples there in Phoenix along these old, 40th Street and 44th Street. I think 40th Street
is the
main.
McDowell, too, that has stretches of residential homes that have been converted to pretty high-end offices and restaurants, yeah. Too, successfully.
Osborne Thomas, there's several examples in Phoenix.
Yeah, and successfully. And like I said, that one restaurant is, I wish I could remember the name of it, I'm sorry. But I've been to it several times. It's great, and it's packed because it's such a great amenity to the neighborhood and people come in there.
And our point is, by limiting it to 1,500 square feet, you're limiting the yeah. impact on the rest of the neighborhood because you can only fit so many parking spaces, right. So many people in that limited space.
You've challenged me to my very core beliefs again. And I have to sit there. I bet Tom Rawls is just cheering about this right now and his look at things. I was looking for his name on this paper. The challenge being, again, and I know there's a way to work through some of these scenarios, and I'm going to look very narrow-minded in this, but on these major arterials, they lead to streets that lead to neighborhoods. They back up to homes. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really have some impacts and challenges. Now, I'll just take to see if I can politically correct, use this scenario. A corner house that leads into a nice neighborhood, and they decide that they're going to sell milk. I'll just use milk. Mm-hmm. But they stack all their milk carts in the back. They have an increase in trash that's going to need to be picked up. They do live there, and there's going to be an increase in noise. But maybe their small neon sign saying milk on it. Again, I think that is going to have a detrimental impact on property values of folks that are taking their very nest egg and making it the best. And although I know that's wrong, I know that's a more government approach, and who am I to dare say that, but I have always had that conflict of the libertarian look at things as free, whatever you want to use it for, no zoning in place, no parameters, but it does have an effect on other people's values. If you put in, again, extreme, if you put in a waste landfill dump next to my house because that's your highest and free best use, it's going to affect what my highest and best for you. So I don't know how you work through that, but I'm concerned. So sorry about that.
Let me throw this out here because, once again, I think we're going to the extremes. Would you rather have a boarded up house? Like, I go down to University, and I'll tell you, the worst house is in there, very nice neighborhood. The houses on the corner have they're boarded up. Landscaping that you have weeds 3 feet high. By the way, code compliance needs to go down there. And the reason being is that those houses, because they're on the corner of an arterial, are unusable. And so, because they can't do anything, they either become a slumlord rental, or they sit there empty, boarded up, because they can't be used. No, choose your poison.
I would say they probably become a slumlord rental that happens to have a retail use to it now, with a slumlord looking sign.
Well, once again, you're jumping to the assumption that we would do absolutely nothing to demand quality. I think there's a trade-off.
And you're assuming, respectfully, Mayor, that by putting a retail use to that, that's somehow going to improve that building and that use. I don't know if that absolutely translates.
If you do it right, it will.
I'm
not saying this is a free-for-all. I think that's the problem. This is not a free-for-all. I think the trade-off is that
give you a sense of the scale. There's trying to remember the exact. There's a barber shop on University that's been there for years.
Just ruin the neighborhood.
Well, yeah, but the point is that...
That was sarcastic, by the way, Joe. That was a sarcastic remark. I need to quit using sarcasm.
But the point is that the floor area of his particular establishment is probably maybe 1,000 square feet, if he's lucky. It's relatively small. It's been there for ages. It's pretty much a conversion of what used to be a house. The fronts onto an arterial street. We're talking about that kind of scale, fronting onto an arterial.
And that's a wonderful example. Joe's is wonderful, great neighbor. And you know what? I missed that vision, and so that's a great comeback. If that was the vision you were talking about, I get it, and that fits good. So,
Dennis?
Well, I have to admit, I think Alex is causing me to move away from my libertarian viewpoints on these issues. And I can see the corner house with the palm reader type of situation, which is... You know, certainly a different use than Joe's barbecue or Joe's haircut barber salon,
Joe's
which I've been to.
Is a good example.
That's good too. But
you couldn't have a Joe's barbecue in Mesa.
But I think Alex is right to warn against the potential consequences of it, even if it's on the corner of a major arterial, and it's limited in the community. I think we should be cautious on this one because I think it can have the effect of the.
The mayor's idea of the overlay district is something that we can certainly pursue.
Yeah, I'd like to raise a question. Why are we being cautious? And I'm not saying you throw caution in the wind. Why are we saying no when other communities have very successfully said yes and created great things? Why are we saying we won't go there? I mean, you go down to University and there's all these houses that are boarded up that aren't used because the only use we will allow is someone either lives there or you have an office. And yet I go to our neighboring communities. I go to Tempe. I go to Phoenix. I go to our own community with Joe's Barbershop. They have successfully created a framework that encourages high uses. And we're worried about the exception. And I'll guarantee you, we won't have any of these exceptions if we're willing to live with blight. Because that's what we'll end up having. We have it right now. We have houses that are boarded up. We have uses that are not even beginning. And those drag down not only the neighborhood, but since they're on an arterial, they drag down the entire city. Why do we not want to encourage the kind of investment and development that our neighboring cities have and the cities around this country have done successfully? They found a way to do it successfully. They don't have tarot card readers on every neighborhood, on every corner. They don't have the junk. They've somehow figured out a way to make that work. Why are we not willing to do that?
Yeah, I agree, and I really think, to me, it comes down to standards and process. I'm willing to allow a lot of various land use experiments here within our new zoning code because if we continue to do what we've been doing, and it's obviously not working, I mean, we have to be able to embrace some kind of regulatory change to see if we can't nudge the free market to embrace those new changes and make something, find a use that works. But to me, that standard on what it looks like, how it interfaces with the neighborhood, and then the process of the surrounding property owners being able to have input, we need to make sure. And Board of Adjustment, I don't know that totally gets to the process because those are pretty obscure meetings. I would be surprised if you had more than a dozen members of the public attend those meetings. Ever. You sat on that board for a while, didn't you, Council Member? But council meeting is mm-hmm. what people key in on. And so I really feel that needs to be part of the process is because that's where the public is used to coming and engaging on these kind of issues.
Well, and here's a problem I think we've had in Mesa is that we're in either all or nothing kind of a deal. And I think what other communities have done is they've found that balance. Here's where I would reject the total libertarian. Libertarians don't only look at one side of the equation. Because it isn't a free-for-all. Because you can't allow junk because that damages people. Why are we afraid to try new things? And I will say this. Thank you, staff, for throwing out ideas that are advance the cause, so to speak. Thank you so very much for creating the incentives for people to do good things. Why are we telling people no? If someone wanted to go and put a flower shop on the corner right now, I tell them, no, you can't do that. Why do we do that? I think we can demand standards. I think we can put limitations where we encourage good investment, and I have no problem doing that. Let's come up with a thing that encourages that kind of investment, that keeps the junk, the riffraff from happening. We can do that. Other communities do that all the time. We tend to either say, yes, you go all the way, or no. And I appreciate that staff has come up with, I think, is a beginning to a middle ground, which facilitates and concentrates on the facilitation rather than no. Now, where that gets us here, I don't know. Last word from Vice Mayor, then we got to move on, because we're beating this whole thing to death.
In hopes of getting to the next slide.
Oh, well, no, to get to the next bullet point.
Next bullet point, yeah. Wow. Well, okay, how many bullet points left on? Okay. I agree with Councilman Richens. I'm not comfortable with leaving with the Board of Adjustment, mm-hmm. but I would like to see a process where we can maintain control as far as making sure we protect the neighborhoods.
We can define standards as part of that control.
And with that, let's move on to the next bullet.
Okay. I just wanted to remind you we're adding the RSL districts. That's all I needed to say about that.
That's all you need to say about that?
Okay. That's okay. The residential small lot. Revisions to the multiple residence districts. We kind of beat the commercial use question to death. We were going to propose a similar type of process for multiple residence districts that front onto arterial streets. So we'll basically take the same scenarios, same direction you were giving us with a single residence, and work that into the multiple residence districts also. We wanted to kind of confirm the density increases that were being proposed for the multiple residence districts. These were reduced in 1988 as part of that code update. We're proposing to return to those densities to go from 12 to 15 units in the R2, the 17 to 20 in what's now the R3, and from 25 to 30 units in what's now the R4 districts. This would make a lot of properties that are considered non-conforming under the present ordinance conforming, which is generally a better thing to do. We've also added a new RM5 district, we don't have any RM5 districts in the city now, but people could rezone to that with the potential of having up to 43 units an acre.
Thought we were going to get through a slide. Go ahead.
No, I actually just have one question about your last point that you haven't made yet.
About the urban designator options.
What is the high, and I'm not a construction expert here, so what's the highest you can build a structure in wood framing?
Four stories.
It's four stories.
Which is how tall? Is that 40 feet?
About just under 50 feet.
Is that
45,
50 feet?
46 feet. It'd be about 40 to 46 feet.
Is that right?
So yeah, it's just under 50.
I've seen a construction type, a five-story construction type that's a cement platform with four stories of wood framing above it. What's the height there?
Typically it would be about 15 feet, or about 65 feet or so.
I think isn't there a limit for fire code? I think there's a limit as to wood structure. I think, isn't it 60 feet? I may be wrong on that.
It's four stories, whatever. Four stories.
I think it anticipates that where you build the, like a garage of concrete and build on top of that, there's a limit as to how high, and I don't know what that is.
Yeah, if we're doing a platform plus four and an urban designator option,
it's a dual thing. It's four stories or there's a limit. For some reason, 60, 65 feet sticks out.
Yeah, I mean, well, let's consider what's happening, you know, in the industry again here. You know, if you build that platform plus four and wood frame and that exceeds, we wouldn't want to preclude that kind of building type, particularly in a transit zone or something like that.
So we'll
like check
with building safety to confirm the maximum height.
Yeah, could you
right,
plus four.
Right. Let's do the regulation based on what the. It's okay. It's okay.
I'm overstepping.
Most of the time, you make a.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
But yeah, let's just check and see what those industry trends are, and have our zoning regulation conform to that instead of an arbitrary number.
No, I.
Mayor,
understood.
It's all yours.
No, I really apologize. I don't mean to step on you, but habits are hard to break.
Okay.
I'd just like to know if there is, I may be completely off base with that total height, but I think it's a combination of four stories and or some total height.
Right.
And I believe that's a fire code deal. But,
yeah.
If you could just let me know what that is, just for my own sake. Just
well, we'll get that to your chief of staff.
Let me fill that in your backyard.
Okay. Okay, the revisions to our commercial districts.
Yeah, the Vice Mayor said, how high can granny flats be? How many stories? Go ahead.
What we actually, as we explained.
Next slide, Gordon.
Okay. Okay, I'm on a roll now. I've got a slide down. I've got two slides down. We've created a buy right option for multiple residence district and commercial use in commercial districts. For multiple residence uses in commercial districts, this still guarantees a certain amount of commercial activity in the commercial district, but they can add up to 25 dwelling units an acre in, for example, the C2. We provided an option for commercial plant nurseries in what's now the C2 district, what we're calling the LC.
Let me ask you that real quick. Uh-huh. So existing C2, does this, if we adopt this thing, is that an added right that goes to existing C2, or would they have to come in for some sort of change?
It would
be
an added right.
It just added on. Okay, good.
They have a special use permit option for plant nurseries. Currently, you can only do a plant nursery in a C3 district. This would allow plant nurseries to go into C2 through a special use permit process, again, through Board of Adjustment. We are allowing research and development uses in what's called the GC, or now it's called the C3 district, and the MX districts. This is a quasi-industrial activity into a commercial activity that's, the idea is the office type of activity that might be adjacent to it. Allow personal services and small retail uses in the OC district. This is the office commercial district. Personal services would include things like barbershops, beauty salons, shoe repair, things along that line. Small retail, again, we're using the 1,500 square foot as the limitation on this. Typically, the OC district tends to be the transition district between the larger commercial districts and residential.
Okay, quick question, Mayor. Isn't that currently, the OS as it is today, right. Isn't it office services anyway? And wouldn't it include that or not?
No, they're currently precluded from the OC.
The personal services, haircut, nail places.
You can only do that in C1.
Now, doesn't that actually, the office services, like you say, it's that buffer, so it's lower intensity drive cars. By allowing this, doesn't that bump back up to a higher commercial use and maybe not as good of a...
It makes my area, right? What we're trying to do is, again, limit the scale as opposed to just being taking a broad brush land use approach where we just prohibit the land use altogether. We're saying this activity is okay if we limit the scale.
Is it something that could actually, it's going to be by right once we say it, right?
Yes.
So, let's just talk the citrus area, right, and where we have allowed some OS office low intensity. You wouldn't be able to preclude it from that type of area any longer.
No, I would not.
So then, some of those things are never going to ever be developed because now you've broadened the OS or that OC zoning to allow so many other things inside.
I don't know if it would preclude development. It might encourage some of the smaller scale.
Well, no, because your neighborhood would come out against anything ever, and for good reason. Because now the intensity's higher. So I see what you're doing, but I'm worried that it's too big of bigger brush that might allow much activity.
The second option on this would be to say instead of making it by right, we make it by special use permit.
I would be happier with that because then again it would be able to allow you to look at the exact area so that it would work.
Does that work for the rest of the council?
Yeah, since they're talking, we're going for yes. All right, good job. Mayor wasn't awake. We all agreed on that, Mayor.
No, I hadn't thought about it in the way you thought about it right there. I'm going against every principle. No, wait, that's already been used today. Alex has already used that. I can't use that. I'm torn because I think you'd make a very good point, and I think we could actually have the unanticipated impact on that. But on the other hand, frankly, I don't like this ever-expanding list of special use permits that come back to council. Maybe a Board of Adjustment type activity or something.
No, a special use permit is Board of Adjustment.
Yeah. Well, I know, and I just want to make sure that on one hand that we strike that balance where there are basic policy decisions that we should not throw into special use permit. Use permit is an application of a policy, mm-hmm. In my mind, and that's why I think we felt uncomfortable with that, the change in the overall area for offices.
Single residence to commercial.
On this one, I don't know. I'm torn between. Part of me says let it happen. because I don't think it's going to be that big of a deal, and I think the kind of use you're talking about is not. The other half is I tend to agree with Councilmember Higgins, so I don't know.
Well, you agreed with me today, Mayor.
I agree with you a lot. Come on. I agree with Alex a lot. I just don't know which Alex I'm agreeing to sometimes. Is it the principled one or the one that's given up all his principles?
So I guess based on this, I would say, you know, I would not like to see the personal services expanded in the OC.
So the issue you have is the by right. You'd rather have it be an allowable with permit, with an SUP.
I would.
Okay.
Because
any objection
area,
to that?
It would make a difference.
Any objection to that? Okay. I think you got your direction.
Okay. Same thing with small restaurants. This kind of goes to your 44th Street example. It would be the same thing. They would be allowed in OS. The difference in this is that they're accessory. Now, typically, we have some office complexes that are relatively large, but you have to have the office complex, and then once the office complex is there, then you have the option for the restaurant. It's not the restaurant as a by right standalone activity in the OC.
So it's treated as an amenity rather than
as a... This would, okay. This is the Michelle's Delicatessen
in
the office building.
My only concern is, when you say, this restaurant's smaller than 1,500 square feet.
Yes.
But is it possible to say that the district or the area it's in or the office building it's connected to is bigger than a certain amount? You know, so you don't end up with one of the little houses we're converting at 1,500 square feet to an office, and then we add the restaurant next door, and now our 3,000-foot house is all.
We could make this accessory based on whether or not the office was at least 5,000, 10,000 square feet.
You know, that would make more sense to me, because then that becomes an accessory use as opposed to, you know, a one-person office. Now you have a restaurant next door. And depending on the area, it might make a difference to me. Anyway.
Or at least a percentage of the building.
True. Okay.
Okay. We'll work on that.
Okay.
Next item.
And reiteration that farmers markets right now require a C3 district or an industrial district. We're saying that you can go now and down into a C2 or a C1. With a temporary use permit.
Right. I think that's good.
We've split up the commercial recreation classification. Right now it's extraordinarily broad. We've broken bars out of that as a separate use. It does require a council use permit in what's now the C2 district, and it's by right in the C3, similar to what the council decided a few years ago. The small-scale commercial recreation, which is basically indoor activities, we basically split out billiards and pool halls. If they're less than 50,000 square feet, they're by right. If they're above 50,000 square feet, it would require a special use permit. If they have a restaurant license, a pool hall would be a by right condition in C2, what's now C2. If they have a bar liquor license, it would require a council use permit in the C2 district, similar to what the council has done with bars.
Mayor. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm confused with the LC and the GC again.
I'm trying to use the new terms, but the LC is C2, GC is C3.
So we're going back to the issue that I think Councilmember Fincher was on planning and zoning at the time when we looked at allowing bars in C2 districts again. Mm-hmm. So we're back to that issue that's in here somehow.
Right. The bar issue remains the same. The difference is that we're basically using the bar example as an example for pool halls.
Yeah, I don't get it. Can you explain again? Okay.
If you have a bar license in the C2 district, it requires a council use permit. If bar license in a C3 district is by right.
Okay.
Okay. Pool halls, if a pool hall has a restaurant liquor license, we would make that by right in C2. If a pool hall has a bar license, not a restaurant license, but a bar liquor license, that would be a council use permit in C2.
Okay. I think I get it.
Alex?
And I know we're wore out with all this, losing our voices. I did learn a lesson in P&Z. I was adamantly opposed to this because I saw the strip center, the bar, the pool hall going in. You know, families going to get their groceries, having to walk through an encounter, whatever. I have seen where some reasonable looks at that, and I'm trying to remember the business there at Power and University. It works. I mean, there's been some good consideration. I'm still kind of on the record. I wouldn't want to see it in a Fry's shopping mall next to Fry's and
having a hardcore bar, biker bar with the pool hall. I just don't want to do it again. But, you know, I've seen some, so far we haven't had to deal with it, so.
Okay.
I'm just thinking about pool halls. We got trouble. Right here.
In River City.
Capital T, and that rhymes with P in that next item.
Okay. Large-scale, and basically this is just confirmation, and large-scale commercial recreation continues to be a C3 activity. The revisions to the employment districts, basically recycling right now requires M2 and a council use permit. We've broken that out by scale, saying that smaller-scale activities can go into commercial districts. And if it's an outdoor activity, may require a special use permit. But if it's a major recycling activity, like that still would require an industrial zoning district. We've added specific airport activities. This was at the request of the airport. Particularly aircraft maintenance, refueling, and terminal parking lots can be done outdoors. Normally employment districts require the activities to be done indoors. We clarify again that plant nurseries are allowed in the employment districts with a special use permit. And we've added the new HI district. Currently we have PEP, M1, M2. This would be a functional equivalent of an M3 district. But what we've done is for really high impact activities, for example, meat rendering plants, petroleum distillation plants, things like that. Right now they would require an M2 district with a council use permit. That removes some of the legislative options that the council has in considering those cases. We now require them to go into an HI district, which gives you full legislative options in terms of how you consider those particular cases.
Quick question. So the HI district, that would be like the CRM, the chrome rubber plant, the CMC steel, those bigger?
Yes.
And right now they have
Fuji chemical plant
right.
on.
They have to come through.
Or TRW with all their mass numbers of employees.
Yes.
Right. They would have to come through currently a special use permit in it within M2.
No, they would have. It would be a council use permit in M2. But because it's a council use permit, if the M2 zoning is already there, you don't necessarily have the wide range of legislative options to consider that case that you would if you had to rezone the case. If it was a rezoning case.
So in the HI, though, they can just move in. We don't have to go through all.
If the HI is already existing, we have no HI zoning
right.
now.
Right. Okay. Awesome. Thank you.
Okay.
With all these plant nurseries and farmers markets, I worry about the new medical marijuana law. Actually, it probably should be. I mean, I make a little joke there, but if it passes, we may want to address that distribution.
We've already been given some good feedback that that's something we need to look at, and so I've asked staff start putting something together to bring back to council pretty quickly. And thanks to Councilmember Kavanaugh, kind of gave us a heads up on that. So,
and before Gordon goes to his next slide, we're going to start kind of a different topic here about the TMX versus the form-based code. We could have another pretty good discussion about this. We're going to be back next week. I'm wondering if you want to save this for next week. I know you've got other things.
Thank you, John.
Because I think BMX is great.
I rode those
when
I
was a kid.
My kids did.
Oh, TMX. I'm sorry. These acronyms just get me. DMC, not DMX. DMX is a band too. I can't. I'm just not hip like you guys are. I am incredibly unhip. You know, hey, thank you, Gordon. I know this is laborious, but you know, these are important things we're talking about, and I really appreciate the time and effort you guys put into it. And the, you know, as you can see, there's some good valid questions as to how we go forward. We're setting the stage for some pretty important activities, so appreciate that.
Thank you.
Okay, unless somebody's got a meeting that they really, really want to report on, we're going to skip that and go right to Mr. Brady for the schedule.
Yeah, Mayor, just quickly, there's a Community and Neighborhood Services Committee meeting at 4 o'clock this afternoon, a few hours from now, no. And then this evening, there is a mayor's conversation with the community from 6 to 7:30 at the ASU Polytechnic Student Union, which is the Cooley Ballroom. So invite everyone from the city who would like to come and attend that. And this Friday evening, we have the Mesa Arts Center season kickoff party, which starts at 6 o'clock. So invite everyone down for that.
And as part of that, at 7, Kyle, is it?
Which one?
This Friday night.
7 o'clock.
As part of that, the kickoff is the Sister Cities concert.
in the Akita Theater at 7 o'clock as part of that kickoff. It's one of the activities. Ms. Crocker, do we have a request to speak from any citizen?
No request, Mayor.
All right. Entertain a motion in an executive session.
So
have a motion from the Vice Mayor, second Councilman Richens. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We will now move into executive session. Thank you so very much.